Well, thanks, Joe. Thanks, Bill. Thanks, all of you, for being here. I'm Jimmy Paulus over alcohol. And extremely grateful to be here and extremely grateful to see all of you here. It tells me that you've decided to either continue on or build upon the sobriety that you already have. And I don't care if it's just one day. This is a move in the right direction. And tonight when I speak about my God, myself, and my program, and what gives me an exciting day every day. And to me, it's beyond just not drinking. It's beyond just not putting down the drink a day at a time. To me, it's sobriety. And my friend, sobriety to me, and I love to explain it as I go along, sobriety to me is not drinking a day at a time in absence of inner turmoil. In absence of inner turmoil. No more knots in that stomach. No more fears, apprehensions. No more doubts. It's just a powerful way to live, and it's an exciting way to live, and that's what sobriety is, because I've often said, and I've often thought, and I've often learned and understood that this program of Alcoholics Anonymous is more than just not drinking a day at a time. This is a spiritual program. It's a spiritually founded program, and let me tell you something. Anything spiritual is fulfillment. Anything spiritual is abundance. Did you know that? You're engendering, you're doing a program of abundance. Abundance. And this is a program that in a sense, dissipates the lack in our lives. I found out through AA and through my spiritual growth in this AA program that if I have a problem or a negative situation in any area of my life, it simply means to me that there's a spiritual lack in that area. There's a spiritual lack in that area. And all I have to do is look toward my spiritual powers. And in a sense, because that's what abundance is. And that's what prosperity is. This program wants us to prosper in all that we do. And we can if we believe. If we believe. But you know, I got sober up in New York State. And I moved down here about 10 years ago. And you know, I guess it's a southern adage that as you move south, they say anytime a northerner or a Yankee crosses the Mason-Dixon line, they run into the first convenience store and ask what part of Florida they're in, you know. And, well, I was never that naive. But I'll tell you, I'm really feel honored and really feel, in a sense, joyful that I was asked to speak here tonight for this 35th Rock Eagle workshop right here in the heart of Miami Beach. Now that just evens it up for somebody that don't like the Yankees in this room. But you know, wherever you go, we're the same. Did you know what we're doing? I was talking to a guy the other day that was complaining about his friend's wife, and I says, you know, the problem is people don't realize when two people get married, when they stand at the altar, you know, sometimes there's a physical beauty or a physical attraction, but did you know that what you're doing, you're marrying two minds? Did you know that? It's two minds. That's what counts. Our minds is up here is what our count. And I remember that the most hurting and frustrating times of my life were when my own worst enemies were my own thoughts. And let me tell you something, my friends, through AA, this AA program and through spiritual growth and spiritual embodiment, I now begin each new day in joyous celebration. Because when I changed my thinking, I changed my entire life, and you can too. And this is the way it begins. All we do at first is put down the drink a day at a time. Put down the drink a day at a time. I live in Smyrna now, oh, boy, there we are. We got a couple, you know. Yeah. Well, Fred here is from Brooklyn. Let's hear that. But my friend Joe drove me over. And you saw Joe stand up here. Now, you know, that's an Irish mug right there. And if you can, they say you can always tell an Irishman, but you never tell him much. And, of course, my family come over on the boat, my descendants from County Tipperary. And It's a funny thing, but it was during the potato famine over in Ireland, and so they come over to the United States to get a new start. And as a young kid, I was wondering, I says, what is it that would cause a nation of people to leave their loved ones and their family and this and that and go to another company or another country because they ran out of potatoes? You know? I says, wow. You know, and that's probably the alcoholism in us. But on the way down, we're talking about Irish culture, and then I'll get off it. But, you know, it's really something. The one thing we both miss the most that we had, in a sense, walk away from when we came into this AA program and resolved to stay sober, that is not to drink a day at a time, was to walk away from and forget about the famous Irish seven-course meal. Boiled potato in a six-pack. You know, they say if it wasn't for the booze, the Irish would rule the world. I better quit this. I was at a meeting, I think about 4:30 before we came here, at a meeting over here, you know, and I heard several fellows in saying, you know, this is the first time at the Rock. And they're a little apprehensive and maybe a little bit nervous, too. Well, this is not only my first time here, but a guy tapped me on the shoulder and says, "You're our opening night speaker." I says, "Well." So, you know, but like a good God scout, be prepared. Like a good God scout, when you're spiritually sound, you're ready for anything. It don't make no difference. You're standing up in front of one person or 300. What's the difference? Unless you let your mind tell you there's something more devastating with an accumulation of people rather than one or two. And what I like to talk about in sobriety is the mind, because let me tell you this. When I came into this AA program, I learned something. They told me about people, places, and things. They says, "Jimmy, one thing you have to do is keep away from the same people and the same places and the same things that, you know, you thought would cause you to drink. You know, like don't hang around the bars and this and that." And I said, "Wow." I said, "You know, the first, foremost, and most important person I have to stay away from then is myself. Because I'm the one that caused myself all this dilemma. I'm the one that did all the drinking. And how can I stay away from myself? I can do it, and you can too. Change yourself. Don't be that same person. Because a different person, you know, the same mind that comes in here, the alcoholic mind, I don't care if it's in here one day, one week, one month, one year, that same mind will always want to drink. Did you know that? The alcoholic mind will always want to drink. The alcoholic mind will never be comfortable in these rooms. The alcoholic mind will never be relaxed in these rooms. The alcoholic mind will never accept what it hears in these rooms. Did you know that? You heard people in here 6 months, a year, year and a half, 2 years. "Oh, I wish I could drink like normal people." Well, that's an alcoholic mind speaking. That's not a spiritual mind. That's an alcoholic mind speaking. And what alcoholic wants to drink like normal people? Hold on, yeah. I go into a lot of the jails, prisons, and penitentiaries, and my alumni. And I tell them, guys, straight out, I says, "I want to tell you something. Now, listen, if this doesn't make sense, you see the simple quotation. This doesn't make sense to you. If you leave here," meaning go out on parole or when your time is up or whatever, "if you guys leave here with the same mind that brought you here, you're going to come back." Now, does that make sense? Of course it does. If you leave here with the same mind that brought you here, you're going to come back. If you come in here and retain the same mind that you came in with, the alcoholic mind, you'll probably drink again or never be comfortable in these rooms. And you know what? Somebody that knows they're powerless over alcohol, somebody knows they're alcoholic, but still doesn't want to stop, is what we call a double-minded person. And a double-minded person will never be content. A double-minded person cannot be content sitting in these rooms wishing they were in a saloon. Or sitting in a saloon knowing they should be in this room. We have to do one or the other. The time comes when we have to make the decision. And a guy said to me, "Well, you know, Jimmy, I hear you speak at a lot of meetings, and I hear you in a lot of discussion meetings, and you always say, 'I'm Jimmy Powers over alcohol.' What's the matter? You afraid to say you're alcoholic? You ashamed to say you're..." No, I'm an alcoholic. I say that many times. But when I address myself to anything or anybody, I say, "I'm Jimmy, I'm powerless over alcohol." "Why do you say that?" And I says, "Listen, I've been sober last month 25 years. Without a drink, yeah." I was telling some guys early, I came in this program when I was 42 years old, so don't think that it's too late. Now I'm a high school dropout, but 42 and 25, is, the guy told me, Joe told me, 76, right? No, 67. And well, either jail preserves here, I was pickled by that booze for so long. But I don't look that old. But I don't feel old, you see, because the soul knows no age. The soul knows no age. And this is what's important. And so I talk in front of some youth a lot, you know, and I say, you know, you guys might think that you're so young that drugs and alcohol can't devastate you. Well, take a good close look at me, my friends. I'm only 18 years old. See, sobriety can be a riot, I'm telling you. I'm telling you, it really can. But it's all the way you look at it. You know, let me tell you something about sobriety. Dean Martin said this once. Dean Martin says, I just met Fred here. He's from Brooklyn, and I'm from Syracuse, from New York, see? And I says, geez, you look like De Niro. He says, you talking to me? Got a tail on him, looks there. Right? Dean Martin says, I feel sorry for you people who don't drink. Because when you wake up in the morning, that's as good as you're going to feel all day long. How many in these rooms feel the same way? That when they wake up in the morning not drinking, that's as good as they're going to feel all day. Because they have not, in a sense, engendered into sobriety, just not drinking. And that's what I want to talk about tonight. You know, how to enjoy the sobriety. How, in a sense, to give yourself a new life. This program is dynamic. It's so exciting that it's unbelievable. But to miss it all, just to come to meetings. I asked the guy, you know, how come you go to meetings? He says, well, so I don't drink, you know. Well, that's good. I mean, that's what we have to do, not drink. But he has no life beyond that, just not drinking. I first came around the program up in New York at an occasion to ride this guy that said he had 8 years sobriety. 8 years sobriety, and holy Christ, I went into his home and the dog barked at him. His wife screamed, you know, don't cross this guy. He's death, I'm telling you. He's not 8 years sober. He's 8 years without a drink. And so sobriety to ourselves, you know, that third tradition says the only requirement is a desire. And you see, everybody in this room, how do we know who doesn't have the desire? It doesn't mean that you have to leave the room, but it means you yourself are not a member until you get that desire. Why? Because I'll tell you something. What the mind doesn't understand, it rejects. Did you know that? I left school because when they come to algebra and trigonometry and those formulas, you know, no, that ain't for me. I can do 2 and 2, and I can do 3 minus 2 or something, you know. That was it. I didn't want to learn the formulas and this and that, so I quit. And it's the same thing in these rooms. They say that what the mind doesn't understand, it rejects. Well, how come some of us get it after a while? That's when we start to become willing. You see, once you become willing, you will accept. And a guy said, well, listen, you know, you read the steps and twists and things. Well, becoming willing doesn't mean you have to. You ever hear all these negatives in these places? Well, just because it doesn't mean you have to. No, listen, when you become willing, it means you want to or you're not willing. Jeez. When you become willing, that means you want to. And when you want to, that's when you will. Because this guy kept coming and going. You know, in and out. He spent more time in the saloons than he did in the AA rooms, you know. And he says to me one day, you know, bleary-eyed and whatever, he said, Jimmy, when do you think I'll get this program? Jeez. I says, I'll tell you, my friend, when you want it as desperately as a drowning man wants a breath of fresh air, you'll probably get it. And that's what takes most of us. It doesn't have to. Nobody has to hit a bottom. But the alcoholic mind forces us to. One more time, one more day. Jeez. I was a 7 day, and the guy said to me, you know, first year in the program is coming on New Year's Eve. And he says, well, I'm getting nervous. And I'm getting nervous. I says, why? And he says, well, New Year's Eve, I always got, you know, oh, geez, I got so drunk. And I says, let me tell you something. If you're alcoholic like me, every day was a holiday and every night was New Year's Eve. I mean, what's this New Year's Eve? Like it's something different? You're trying to get drunk every night, right? To the best of your ability, to the most you can. So now it's New Year's Eve. So I said, well, look at, picture this, I said. Supposing it became New Year's Eve, and you're all upset and nervous and all because it's New Year's Eve, and then you looked at the calendar, oh, wait a minute, it's next week. See, it's all mental. Everything is mental in this life. It's all mental. Like my wife, when I was on the, I'll tell you about my story, but I was on the lam down in Baltimore, Maryland, and we lived on this little hill in this apartment, and we looked out, and she says, well, she says, you know, it's 2 weeks now, and the rent's going to be due, and we don't have it, you know. Then it was 10 days and the rent's due. Then it was 8 days and the rent's due. Seven. Finally, I says, hey, Sal, listen, let me tell you something. When the first of the month comes and I don't have the rent, then worry. Right now, this is all premature. It's premature worry. And that's what we do with our lives. We worry prematurely, you know. When this day comes, if I don't have this or that, well, let me tell you something. That's because you're still thinking humanly. Well, Jimmy, that's all I got is a human. No, no, let me tell you something, my friend. The human mind is the carnal mind. And I'm not talking Jerry Springer stuff, the carnal mind. The carnal mind is the sinful mind or the lascivious mind or whatever. And then there's the spiritual mind. You see, a person says, I only have one mind to think with. No, my friend, we must be born again. Born again in thought. Born again in thought. And until we are, we're going to walk around with the same, listen to this, the same mind that creates the problems in life is not smart enough to solve them. If it was, it wouldn't create them in the first place. It takes a new and different mind. You must put that mind under the bed in the morning and take on the spiritual mind. You see, understand it. We have to. Because until we become spiritual in thought, I'll tell you why we must be spiritual. I must tell you why this is a spiritual program, and there will be no change in our lives or our drinking habits until we do become spiritual, simply because this. I once put a flower that was almost dying. I don't know much about them. It was in this little pot, you know, and it was looking real bad. And somebody told me, well, put some water in it and put it in the window. Well, put it in the window for where? I put it in the window. There's a little ledge by the window. See? Well, we got 3 or 4 days of nice sunshine, this and that, and I watered the plant, and all of a sudden it was opening up, it was blossoming, and it was leaning toward the sunshine. Wow. And then I learned, you know, any living thing separated from its source will wither and die. When we were out there drinking, when we were out there weeping and wailing, when we were out there suffering with lonely days and lonely nights that were slowly evolved into wasted days and wasted nights, we were separated from our source, our God, our Creator. And now when I'm in this program, when I put down the drink a day at a time, and when I take on a spiritual aspect of my life, I reach toward my Creator like that flower. And all of a sudden, I'm filled with new life and new juice and whatever. And if someone in this room, and it doesn't make a difference to me, if they don't believe in a God, that's your business. If someone in here believes in a different God than I do, that's your business. If somebody believes in a God, or thinks they believe in a God, like I did when I first came in this program, you see, I thought I believed in God. And when I came in here, I began to realize as I got into spirituality, I didn't believe in God. I only believed there was a God. I didn't believe in God because I didn't understand God. You know, God's an important part of this program. It's usually the steps around the wall. I can't read them anyway, but I think it's 6 or 7 steps, either say or indicate God. So, I mean, it's part of this program. There was no AA. You know, even Bill and Dr. Bob, you know, they were so hopelessly alcoholic. And there was no way out until Abby came into Bill's kitchen, and he mentioned the word religion, but we know he meant spiritual, and the God of your own understanding. And until that happened, there was no program. There was no relief. They tried lobotomies. They tried insane asylums. They tried jail. They tried drunk wards. Nothing was working until the love of one drunk reaching out to the other. You know, the spiritual aspect of life. That's what gave us this program. That's what gives us our life. Take God out of the program and we don't have it. Because there was nothing without Him. And so, when we bring God into our life, well, we must have an understanding of God. We must have an understanding of God. You know, let me tell you what helped me. You see, I was brought up Irish, you know, they send you to Catholic school. And I was telling Fred, I says, and I got the scar tissue to prove it. Some priests and nuns would whack you with the rosary beads and like that. You know, one time, oh, I used to sell roofing and siding. I told the guy, I says, yeah, and I got the indictments to prove it, too. But you know what? I did have a basic idea of God, and I believe in God, but I believe God, you know, the punishing God and this and that. And every time I'd go to the slammers, I'd say, well, God's trying to teach me a lesson. It ain't that I broke the damn law. God's trying to teach me a lesson. He's trying to wake me up. And I'd say, please, God, get me out of this jail cell, and I'll never do it again. God's going to put on a three-piece suit, go up before the judge, and argue your case, and let you beat the rap, you know, because you said, please, and I'll never do it again. See, I mean, you know, I got a wrong concept of this guy, God, and whatever. And then I began to realize, you know, he's a loving God. But what do they mean by a loving God? It means that, well, I heard a TV evangelist talk a few months ago. And this guy's probably all right because he hasn't been indicted yet either. And most of them guys are, you know. And he was talking over the weeks about this child in the congregation that was real sick. I guess it was like a year or so old. And they were all praying for this child in the hospital, one of the congregation. Well, one day he comes to a Sunday on the TV and he says that the child died. And he said, we don't know why God took this child. Must be for his own reason, see. Now, unbeknown to him, he's calling God a killer. You see, if God, they say he's a respecter of no one. That means he doesn't respect anyone. It means he doesn't respect anyone more than the other. He doesn't do one thing for you than he wouldn't do for me. And if he takes one life, he takes them all. If God takes one child's life for whatever his reason is, as they say, then he takes everybody. He's responsible for all them deaths in Yugoslavia. He's in charge of all the fiery plane crashes. He's the giver of cancer, of AIDS, of all these sicknesses and illnesses, and people die. And if God takes one life, if he takes one life for his own purpose, for his own reason, he, in a sense, causes suffering upon the members of that family, maybe hardship, maybe monetary hardship if he takes a husband. God doesn't do this. God says, I am the author and giver of life. I have come so that you may have life more abundantly. And when I start believing in that God and understanding sin is the cause of death, you know, let's put blame where it lies. Jeez, I had juries convict me. I mean, let's go by the evidence. And the evidence is simply this, that God does not even, like just saying our sobriety, a guy told me once I was sponsored, and he says, Jimmy, God's testing me. I says, what? Well, yeah, he says, geez, I went out this morning, the car wouldn't start, and this and that, and something else happened, you know. God's testing. I said, God ain't testing you. See, God knows your mind. He knows your capabilities. He knows what's he going to test you for? Not only that. Yeah. But not only that, if you fail, it's God's fault. He tested you too much, right? He is. God doesn't give us anything more than we can have. That doesn't mean God piles negative situations on us. Because if he did, we couldn't shrug them all off. How are you going to pray to the God that's putting all this on you? Does that make sense? See, this is, I started getting some common sense in this program. Don't pray to the God that's doing it to you. Edward G. Robinson, you know. You remember Edward G., that guy. He had the gun on this guy, see? And this guy's kneeling down, he's praying. He says, please, please don't. He says, please, God, don't let him kill me. And Edward G. says, what are you praying to God for? I'm the guy with the gun. You pray to me. But that's how complicated life can be. We don't know which way to turn sometimes. So what we do, we open the big book. We have to do that. We have to call our sponsor or call some friends. And understand that it's usually a common sense remedy. It's nothing too deep. Nothing spiritual is complicated. If it was, it wouldn't be of God. You see, anything of God to me is blissful. You know what blissful is? Blissful is like walking on air. It's just the most beautiful feeling. And anything of God is blissful, and anything of God is instant. It's instant. It's right away. Oh, come on, Jimmy, that woman said. You know, you're talking about instant sobriety. I says, yeah. She says, well, there's no instant sobriety. I says, what do you mean? And she says, well, you know, I come in here, and after 3 or 4 days, I was still sick and everything else. I says, wait a minute. What it is God wants you to have it. He wants each and every one of us right now, right this very moment, healthy, happy, wholesome, and prosperous immediately. That's God's will for you. That's God's will for you. Healthy, happy, wholesome, prosperous immediately, right now. But he knows our minds are not capable of accepting all that at once and acting on it. So all he expects us to do each day is add a little to what we've got. Now, I don't know who's new around here or who can remember back when they were fairly new coming in this program, or even right now, having a bit of a troubled life or a little bit of a not understanding your situations and your problems in life, and just forget about them problems. You know, my God told me, he said, Jim, you must love your problems more than you do me. And I says, what that? And he says, well, you spend more time thinking about your problems than you do me. And that was true, see. I used to think if I didn't worry about my problems, they'd get worse. And come to find out that the more I worried about my problems, the only thing that got worse was me. It doesn't mean we don't try to remedy them, but we don't go wacko over it either. All we have to do is turn spiritual. As we grow spiritual, our lives will improve in all areas. Economics, you know, finances, relationships, you name it, it will improve. You know why? It has to improve. And I'll tell you about that. Simply because that Irish kid over there read the promises, right? Murphy, right? Riley, yeah. Yeah.
Close enough. Riley.
The promises. Hey, listen to this now. You read the promises and they sounded great. But you want to know something? They weren't the hopes. They weren't the wishes. They weren't the desires. They were the promises. The promises means they have to happen. They have to happen. They're promised to us. It's spiritual. When something spiritual is promised to you, it has to happen. It ain't that I hope I get a few, or how come this sucker over there has gotten... Yeah, yeah. Well, let me tell you something, my friends. They're promised to us only. There's always a condition. The simple condition is the fact that all I have to do is keep growing spiritually, and they will happen. They will happen. You see, spirituality encompasses every area of our life, and it sweeps it up all into one. A woman up north said at a meeting, she says, well, happiness is a byproduct of sobriety. And I said, I'm sorry, ma'am. Her problem was I was chairing. I said, I'm sorry, ma'am. It's not a byproduct. I said, it's a mandated ingredient. You know, I says, now, I'm not a woman. I don't bake a cake. But I did watch my mother. And she put in the vanilla, the sugar, the flour, you know, all that stuff and mix it up. And it's all in there. It's all part of the cake. Happiness is an ingredient, a necessary mandated ingredient of sobriety. But it's not really happiness. It's joy. And it's not just joy. It's inner joy, inner peace. That's what we get when we turn spiritual, when we grow spiritual. You know, a guy said, Jimmy, you're supposed to qualify yourself before a meeting, you know, like you drank. I said, geez, they listened to me for 5 minutes. They'll know I drank. Let me say this, in a sense, you know, we all got our own bottoms and whatever, and some people sleep in the weeds, God bless them. Some people go to the mental institution, some go to rehabs, whatever. You know, in a sense, they call it the bottom. Mine was jails, penitentiaries, and prisons, you know. But I'll tell you something. In the year 1957, from an upstate New York penitentiary, I had a dream. I had a dream that one day I'd be a wealthy person before I left this earth. But never once did I realize that alcohol and or the pursuit of alcohol gave me that penitentiary dilemma. Well, in 1964, my friends, I was worth $52,500. Dead or alive? Yeah. And never once did I realize that alcohol and or the pursuit of alcohol had put that bounty on my head. I didn't realize that. Well, in 1967, in the early years of a 40-year prison sentence in Attica State Prison, I was working in the metal shop on an outdated punch press machine earning 6 cents a day. Wow, 6 cents a day. A five-day week was 30 cents. Anything I wanted to do with it, 30 cents a week. Never once did I believe that alcohol and or the pursuit of alcohol put me in such a top wage bracket. When that judge sentenced me to 40 years, that didn't bother me so much. I was conditioned for it. I was living that kind of life. What bothered me was he said, at hard labor. Now, I says, Judge, that's the one thing I tried to avoid all my life. I tried to be a success without a high school education. And he says, well, son. But, you know, that was it. Yeah, and I quit high school because of the formulas, the algebra, and whatever. But, you know, something happened to me in high school. I never took a drink in high school. I never wanted to drink. But, damn it, if I didn't win the New York State Golden Gloves when I was up there, and I was still in high school, I was still a teenager, and I had quite a future for a guy that didn't want to work for whatever reason and didn't want to go to school for another reason, so I quit. And I went to the gymnasiums, and I was doing fine. Geez, I campaigned as a New York State light heavyweight and heavyweight champion amateur. I was beating everybody. Pennsylvania, going up in Canada and fighting and whatever. And then I turned pro. And when I turned pro, you know, I still didn't want to drink. I never took a drink. And then I started. You know, you go out with the guys, and they call peer pressure. Peer pressure doesn't mean somebody puts a gun to your head or twists your arm. It means just hanging around with people that are doing things. And sooner or later, you know, unless you have a certain real purpose or reason to resist, which I didn't, I'm with them one night, and I said, let me try one of them beers. And I tried one. Well, I'm alcoholic. I didn't know that. My system took over. I had 6 or 7 beers that night, and I wanted more. But the next morning, I got up for road work, and is it the Cheetah or the Giselle? Well, I would outrun either one of them. Boy, I was fast that next day. Light and airy. I says, wow, this is great. I'm going to incorporate this in my training. Well, I did, you know, but not because I wanted to, because I had to. I was alcoholic. I was powerless and didn't understand it. My system craved it. And I started spending more times in the saloons than I did the gymnasiums. And then one of the worst things that came over me, you know, I used to think the worst feeling in the world, and I guess it still is them headaches and heartaches and hangovers from alcohol. But, man, going in that ring and losing to somebody that you know you can beat because you're not in condition. And even then, blaming it on I wasn't eating right, I didn't do this right, I didn't do that. Never once thinking it was alcohol. Then I got involved with underworld characters. The underworld. I'm not talking about hubcap thieves. I'm talking about, you know, the De Niro people. Well, I was an asset. I'm up in north side of Syracuse. It's mostly Italian, and the mob figures up there in Utica and Rochester and Buffalo and whatever, New York. In fact, Gabe Genovese was training fighters. He's a nephew to Vito. I mean, we all know who Vito is, and I shouldn't mention his name. But anyway, I got involved because they needed people. You know, they had a little, they were doing services. They were loaning out money at exorbitant prices, and they needed somebody to pick it up for them. And so he says, Jimmy, you know, the promoters were backing off me, and so this is how you get started. You know, and I'm going out, and I'm picking up a few dollars here and there and making some money and whatever. But that's what happens, you see. But I continue to drink and continue to drink and continue to drink. And I don't know how many people in this room, but you'll know how it feels if you've ever been extradited on your honeymoon. Well, I did. In 1961, you know, a young girl told me I was good enough to marry her. And besides, she had a whole lot of credit cards, which was new in them days, you know, and I wasn't doing too well. So we got married, and I had to go on the lam. The grand jury was sitting on me on what they call flim-flam scores, confidence scores. And I went to Baltimore, Maryland, and sure enough, I got extradited on my honeymoon. And that doesn't make for a good marriage, except that I did tell her, I wasn't 9 to 5 when she married me, but she wanted to get married. But anyway, safe conviction, safe cracking, when you take money out of a safe that don't belong to you. And I got 5 years probation, and the following year I got involved in in Rochester, New York, a jewelry store swindle, and I got a year in the pen for that, and it resolved the probation. You know, I thought I was getting breaks here, but instead all it was doing was like giving a drunk a dollar, you know, so he can stay drunk. That's what it was doing. And so in 1961 I got married, and 1964, listen to this, I don't know where any of you guys were then, but listen to this classic year. And in Onondaga County, that's where I lived. Well, then I was down near Buffalo, New York, Chautauqua County. I got indicted on 9 counts of forgery. And the state's attorney steps in. He says, Your Honor, this guy, he's involved with organized crime, and he isn't passing the checks or writing the checks, but he's heading a statewide forgery ring that's netting quite a few thousands of dollars every week. And we gotta shut him down. But I made bail and went back to Syracuse, Onondaga County. I got indicted on 54 counts of forgery. And I made bail, and I got indicted in Onondaga County on accessory to robbery in the first degree. And in 1964, I got made bail, and I got indicted again on robbery in the first degree. And now the DA is screaming, you know, that this guy's been to the well too many times and whatever. And all the time, you know, when I would make bail, I'd go back into the saloons, and I'd, you know, because my lawyer, you know what the lawyers, criminal defense lawyers will say, look, Jimmy, we need more money. I don't care how you get it, buddy, but go out and get some more money. Well, I get more money, but I get another indictment with it, you know. Call that the insanity thing. Keep doing the same thing over and over, expecting the same result. I had 4 indictments, and now and they locked me up, and now they won't give me no more bail. And the bonding company thought I was becoming a risk. And in the summer, listen to this, in the summer of 1964, I got indicted by the federal government. And this was in collusion with the Utica mob down there. And a $350,000 postal money order swindle. And now they wouldn't even talk about bail. And you know how I tell you what goes on when you're drinking so much. You don't know half the stuff you're doing. My lawyer says to me, he says, you know, Jimmy, he says, we're going to try and consolidate all these bails. And I had a good criminal lawyer. This guy was very good. And he says, the judge that's sitting on all these is going on vacation for a week or two. I'm going to sneak in and see if we can consolidate all these bails into one and get you out here. I says, great, do it, Frank. So Frank goes, and he comes back about 3-4 weeks later. He says, what the hell did you do in this town? I said, what are you talking about? You know the judge I went to consolidate the bails? I said, yeah. Well, he says, he's one of the guys you swindled. So the old New York saying, forget about it, Frank. Forget about the bail. You know, so I wait a year or so, and I go to trial on the robbery one. And, you know, even before OJ, I can read a jury. I really can. You know, you've been to trial so many times, and your friend's been to trial, and you sit there, and you try to talk to jurors, you know, trying to just tell them maybe they shouldn't do this or shouldn't do that. But anyway, the jury comes back, see. They're out 11 and a half hours. They try me on the robbery one. I got a safe conviction if I get 60 years is max. The jury comes out, see. Now, the men, you're sitting at the defense table. The men look up here, look over there. They won't look at you. The women, why is it? When they convict, they all come out dabbing their eyes. You know? If there was a woman in the room right now, I would ask her, why you cry when you convict somebody? And so the lawyer leans over to me and he says, we're dead. Yeah, I thought of the big 60 years, and I says, what do you mean we, Frank? Me. See, one of the times I had to learn that, you know, you reap what you sow. You have to pay for what you do. I learned that in the boxing ring, too. You see, you make a mistake in boxing, you pay for it. And you try to make the other guy make mistakes so you can make him pay for it. It's really something. You get a real education in anything in life if you look for it, you know. And I was a good guy in the county jail. Now, here's what we're going to decide tonight. do we want to really get sober? Do you want to just stay with the alcohol? I really start enjoying life. In the county jail, my friends, for almost a year, because I had no bail and I'm waiting to go to trial and whatever. I was a good guy, buying this guy cigarettes and this guy that and writing letters to people. You know, they couldn't express themselves. I was a dropout, but I could write and I could express myself to their lawyers, to their family, and whatever. All around good guy, right? I go up for sentencing, and listen to this. The judge is supposed to give me 60 years. He says I'm a one-man crime wave. I got 3 indictments from the state and 1 from the feds waiting for me, right? He looks down upon me, and he only gave me 40. And, boy, I felt great. 40 years is all I got. You see, changing my thinking, changing my mind, already got 20 years off my sentence. Yeah, and I didn't know it. You see, spiritual law doesn't mean you have to know it. You can expand upon it the more you know about it. But I'm not an electrician. I'm afraid of wires. In fact, I can't even find the light switch. But I know if I go up to it and go bink, all the lights will go out. And if I go, I don't have to know about electricity. And the same way with the spirituality. That's why sometimes good things happen to you people. You just don't know. You tapped into a spiritual law. And sometimes poor things happen is because you are non-spiritual in thought. And that's the way it is. So I go up to the Attica prison for 40 years, and that's where they had the infamous riot. I locked next to Jerry Rosenberg, Jerry the Jew. You know, we call him with the iron prison. Jerry locked next to me, and Jerry was the only inmate to ever get a law degree in the state prison in the whole country at the time. Jerry was convicted of killing 2 cops in a robbery in Brooklyn, his time. Not my territory, his. But let me tell you this. Jerry became, they made a movie, and Tony Danza played the part of Jerry Rosenberg, if you remember that, the Attica riots and whatever. Jerry was the inmate's real legal advisor. You don't see it in some of the movies, but he was. He was the one that really guided him. He's a real smart kid. He was getting a lot of guys out of the joint and couldn't get himself out. You see, I changed my thinking in prison. It wasn't the, I had a tough, you know why I had a tough? Because I could do time. I didn't want to be there. But it wasn't the 40-foot wall. It wasn't the slamming of the doors. It was, I could do it. I didn't want to, but it didn't bother me. And it bothered me that it didn't bother me. But I did start to change. Sometimes you say things, and you know, maybe it's God speaking through me, but it also realize this, you know. Albert Einstein was a genius, right? Well, I'll tell you something. When Einstein was in school, the teachers told him he would never amount to anything, and he left school. Well, and became a genius. Yeah. Yeah. So when I was in grade school, the teachers told me I would never amount to anything. So I quit school. And once in a while, I'll say something that might make you think I'm a genius. I don't know. E equals MC2. I don't know. Jerry fought the system all these years. I'm talking about 1964. I'm up in Attica prison when I met Jerry. And what is it now? I don't know. 1999. He's still in the joint. He's in Auburn now. He transferred down to Auburn. But here, you see, I changed my thinking. I paid a good defense lawyer, a good criminal lawyer, thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars, and I got 40 years. And after I got in there, I turned to God and I got out. Jerry never changed his thinking. He's still bucking the system. He's still writing writs and grits and whatever we used to call them. But here's another thing what he did. Talk about this kind of a mind. I don't know. Now it's 10 years ago or so. Jerry had needed open heart surgery. And Auburn prison is right 25 miles from Syracuse. St. Joe's has got heart specialists and all. They rush Jerry there, and they lose him on the table. You know how they do it. They got to pump you back and this and that. And they bring him back to life, and they take him back to the prison. Well, his latest motion, you know, it's been in Time Magazine, Newsweek, and on New York Daily News and everything, see. He was sentenced to a natural life. And he says, I did my sentence on the operating table. I completed my sentence. The only thing, they didn't issue a death certificate, Jerry. That's what I said to him. But that's it. But But Tony Danza played him in the movie, and what are you going to do? You're running all these kind of people. I was one of them guys. So I went to the service unit after I got up in Attica. I got 40 years to do, and the guy says to me, you know, he says, now we're talking 1964 to 2004. But he says to me, you know, you're going to be with us here a long time. I says, what's that? And he says, well, he said, your maximum expiration date is August of 2004. I says, what? Now we're talking about 1964, right? He says, August of 2004. I says, oh, I thought you said September. But that's how you do your time. That's how you do your time in the joint. And even in a rehab, what you do is you don't, in a sense, keep your mind on things like my wife, my girlfriend, my this, my that. You think about them fleetingly. But when you let your mind dwell on it, then you get homesick, and then you're doing hard time. I don't care if it's in a hospital, a rehab, or a prison, or why. You just have to, in a sense, enjoy each day as it comes. You got to do it. If you can't do it, you can't do life. Life is a day at a time, right? This is what's understandable. Jerry's still up there fighting the system. He looks older than me, and I don't think he is. But I ain't died in no operating table yet. So my wife comes up for a divorce. I says, Sal, I only got 40 years. I mean, what are you talking about? The body ain't even cold yet, you know? Well, anyway, she got the divorce and whatever. See, that's another thing. I did not contest it or nothing. I knew. We had a little baby. What am I going to do? She's got to make a life. I got 4 more indictments from the state and 1 from the feds when I get out. I'm going to fight a divorce. Well, let me tell you something. When she first come up, the alcoholic mind, you know what it said? Sarah, how can you leave me when I need you so much? You know, how can you leave me? You know, an alcoholic father, an alcoholic husband, a guy mingling with underworld figures, you know, gone on the lam all the time. Sal, I won't be home tonight. I won't be home for the next 2 weeks. Well, how do I get a hold of you? Call the lawyer. I mean, this was her life. When she went up for the divorce, she said, what the hell? You got the car, you got the rugs, you got the furniture. They're all stolen. You know, and I like to come home with, like one time I come home with about 6 rocking chairs for the kids in the neighborhood. They're all in these boxes. You put them together. Where'd you get them? Well, they fell off the back of a truck. You know. I only hear this stuff once in a while. There was a movie. It was one of them cheap mob pictures. I mean, it wasn't make a lot of sense, but it was mob wife or something. One thing they did say, see, she's going around the house. She's mad at her husband who's in the underworld. She says, everything in this house fell off the back of a truck. What are you going to do? You want to tell me you stole it? I'm sick of this money, she told me once. I'm sick of this mad money. I'm sick of this. I'm sick of this dirty, tainted money. It was in the winter, and we were going out for dinner, you know. I said, you're sick of it all, Sal? Yes, I don't want no more of it. I want you out of that. I said, well, you better take that fur coat off, because that's where it comes from. Well, she didn't talk about that for a long time. I changed my thinking in the prison. You know, I tried to become a different and better person, and I did. And I didn't know why. I heard about the spirituality, but I didn't understand what it was. But I did become a new and better person. And all of a sudden, the miracles started working in my life. The miracles that can work in every one of your lives in this room, starting right now, this very moment. First believe in it, and it will happen. The first thing that happened is, after the attic arrives, they says, they used to call me Dugan in the underworld, because I didn't want to tarnish the family name anymore. You know, I says, Dugan, go on up to parole, you know. They said, holy Christ, I was supposed to do 13-9 to see the parole board, but after the riot, they modified it to 8 years and 4 months, and I went up to the parole board, and they sent me home. First time up! Can you believe that? They're supposed to give me about 2 or 3 hits, but they got. And so then I says, holy crap, now I'm ready to go out of the joint, and I got 4 indictments from the state and 1 from the feds, and I know there's going to be a fight out in front to see who gets me, right? Yeah, that's miracle number 1, just making the parole. I goes out in front, and nobody's there, just my brother-in-law, my friend Joey, who owned the bar. And there was no feds and no state. Miracle number 2. If you do not look upon these as miracles of changing your thinking, my friends, you'll never make it in life.
You'll never be... You know, the one thing this changing your mind will do for you, you will no longer be a victim of life as we were with our alcoholic thinking. You will become a victor over life. And that's what we're here for. Just what we're here for. Sobriety, my friends, once again, not drinking a day at a time in absence of inner turmoil with spiritual fulfillment and spiritual embodiment will give you a victory over life on a daily basis. I used to wake up in the morning and the fellow would say, Jimmy, are you going to have a good day? You know, in the old life. I'd say, I don't know. I got to see what happens, you know. If good things happen, have a good day. If poor things happen... See, I was a victim of the circumstances of life, like placing a child out on a busy highway to fend for itself. That's what we think we're doing in life every day. No, I wake up today knowing I'm going to have a good day. I may not like everything that happens in the course of a day, but with spiritual embodiment and spiritual fulfillment, what used to pierce me like a sword, just a dull thud. Right reaction, my friends, is the supreme art of life. Learn how to react. You can have a wonderful day. But here's what happened. So now I go out, and they pick me up, and the feds in the state ain't there. And let me tell you something. This was the indictments were from 1964. And I've never heard one word about any of them indictments. And one was a serious one with organized crime. Listen to this. It evaporated like cigarette smoke. That's what God does. When you take your eyes off the problem and put them on God, your problems evaporate. Already, I was supposed to do to the year 2004. Then they told me 13-9. Then they gave me 8-4 and told me to go home. Then I'm waiting for these other indictments. That's a miracle. Nobody's there to pick me up on the indictments. They evaporate. Miracle number two. Then I find this AA program after I drank for almost a year. Miracle number three, because I didn't know that alcohol was my real problem. I come into AA, and I was there a short while when parole called me up. Now listen to this, because now God knows your heart. He knows when you're sincere, and he knows when you're bluffing. I was sincere. And parole told me, Jimmy, give us 5 good years from the day you got out. And it's not mandatory, but on recommendation, you can get off parole. Well, I never really tried to get off parole. All I did was practice this AA program in my life on a daily basis. It accommodated parole. They released me. Free as a bird. Wow. Look at the years. You don't call it beating them out of it. Because I'll tell you something. If I was sober and spiritual, it wouldn't matter if I was on parole or not. Because that type of life doesn't interfere with it. No matter what. The guy says, how are you going to get a job? You know, you're an ex-con, you're on parole. I says, to you, I might be an ex-con. To you, I might be on parole. To me, I'm a new person in soul. I'm a new person. See, I don't know if I'm 67 years old. I don't know if I'm 35. The soul knows no age. I feel just as dynamic and powerful and exciting inside. And listen to this. You know, I used to think in sobriety that I had to search for my happiness, you know. You know, like happiness floats around on a cloud, you know. Well, what the hell? Us tall guys would have the sobriety. Yeah. Especially them two sergeants of arms. They'd have it all. They'd get mine away from me. You can call him Sergeant Arms, Bill, but you're talking to a room full of drunks. We know bouncers when we see them. Wow. Well, one guy I saw on the Jerry Springer show the other night. Eliminated parole, that's another miracle. That's another miracle. It's another miracle. And these miracles happen. I went to my first AA meeting. I was kind of bombed. And when I started wakening up, you know, I wake up and I go in the room here's a guy. Sure, I was a prize fighter, a con involved with the underworld. And I'm looking on the wall and, you know, think, let go and let God. And I said, what the hell is this, Sesame Street? You know, what am I doing in here? What the hell am I doing in here, you know? You know, and not thinking I'm brilliant, but I'm smarter than that. Yeah, one old-timer stands up and he says, well, here, he says, we have slogans like easy does it, but do it. And I says, yeah, well, I had a slogan in the other life. And he says, what's that? I said, take it easy, but take it. Yeah, he says, well, look what it got you. So, you know, I realized, you know, I used to think that philosophy, I didn't belong in the same ballpark with a philosopher. But easy does it. First things first, let go and let God. This is philosophy, and I begin to understand, philosophy is nothing but common sense explained. That's all it is. Somebody talks about philosophy, and you say, well, I knew that. I mean, I knew it, but I didn't, but I did. You know, it was in here. And here's what we do about happiness, that stuff going around in the cup. All the wonders we seek, you see, I told you about God. All the wonders you seek are already inside you. These are mandated ingredients, like the lemon and the sugar and the whatever in that cake. These are mandated. It's always, would it be a fair God if I had to reach out somewhere else or I couldn't find happiness? You see, the human mind, it's happiness. Happiness to the human mind is this. It's a guy gets a different car. Maybe not brand new, but it's nice and shiny, whatever, you know. And somebody scratches the car or he gets the insurance bill and the... You know, all of a sudden, happiness is limited and mood set in. This friggin' wreck, you know, and everything else, you know. Happiness to the human mind is playing golf. And the guy's out on the golf course with some guys he works with, and he wants to impress them. And he makes some bum shots, and he ends up throwing the club up in the tree. You know, that's happiness. It's so limited. Happiness is a new friend to the human being, you know. And after that great friendship, and all of a sudden, that friend isn't acting like he wants him to. And all of a sudden, once again, the relationship sours and mood set in. That's happiness. You see, now spirituality doesn't talk about happiness. It talks about joy, inner peace, the most powerful feeling you can have in your life. That I can look at 300 men right now, and most of you I've never seen in your life, and you have never seen me. And I'll tell you truthfully and honestly, each and every one of you right now, can add to my life, but not one of you can take from it. And that's powerful. That's spirituality. That's what we want when we put down the drink a day at a time, to flounder around and say, well, after 2 or 3 years and come in and have this person raise their hand when the chairman says, has anybody got a topic? I'd like to hear more about anger. I'm not trying to ridicule anybody. I'd like to hear more about resentment because I was there. I didn't come in this way. I was there. I crawled in like everyone else. But, you know, I have parables like my God did. You know, and my parable is about the two bums sitting on the bench, in the park bench, and they're down and out, and they got no way to turn. Finally, it's coming to the end. They're passing around the last cigar butt. And one bum says, you know, down the street, see that building? They have meetings down there, and they call them Prosperity Anonymous. Prosperity Anonymous, well, there probably is no such program. Unless Bill goes out and starts one after this meeting. But this is my parable. So these two guys go down. He says, yeah, one bum says, yeah, these guys were like us on the park bench, you know, picking up cigar butts and whatever. And let's go to the meeting. Now they're driving cars and they got suits on, they got money in their pocket. Let's see what's going on. So they go in there and they sit in the back, you know, kind of afraid. And the chairman says, anybody got a topic? So the one bum reaches his hand. He says, yeah. He says, I want to hear more about poverty. He says, poverty? No. No, we don't talk about poverty in here. We're talking about prosperity. Poverty is what we got away from. Understand that. Poverty is what we got away from. And he says, listen, as long as you have thoughts of poverty in your mind, how can you become prosperous? And if you have anything at all and think poverty, you're going to lose it. You see, what the mind thinks is what it attracts. Where my thoughts lie, my heart will soon follow. So when we go to AA meetings now and someone says, I want to hear more about anger. I mean, I don't criticize that. I understand they don't know the difference. But I don't want to hear about anger no more. I don't want to hear about resentment, guilty. I want to hear about how not to get angry. And I can tell you how. Yeah. You can have the greatest stress lesson right in here, right now, and go out and market it, because I might. Because God gave me the answer. because I asked him to give me knowledge and wisdom that them teachers in school didn't give me, because I wouldn't listen. Let me say this, my friends, and this can be a clue to everyone's happiness once they put down a drink at a day at a time and step into the world of sobriety. The world of sobriety, which is simply not drinking a day at a time in absence of inner turmoil. If my God, you see, I heard a guy at an AA meeting, one of my first meetings, say that as an alcoholic, when he started drinking, he had a great position in life, and he lost his position because of the drink. And then he lost his home because of the drink. And then his wife took the children and left because of the drink. And then he continued to drink. And he was coming to meetings on the Salvation Army truck where he lived. He stayed at the Sally. Booze did that to him. The most strongest, most powerful obsession that everyone in this room ever had, right? It devastated our lives. Devastated our lives. But now in sobriety, God, with our cooperation, has removed that. Removed the desire to drink. To me today, drink has no value in my life. No value whatsoever. No attraction whatsoever. My God did that with my cooperation, with my desire, and my praying for help. It can happen. Now, if he can take away that from you, what's the problem with anger, with resentment? There's no problem. But I'll tell you one thing. I would probably, after 25 years sober, if I thought, which isn't a sober thought, but if I thought that in any given situation, good, bad, or otherwise, a drink would help me, I will drink again, because I'm telling you that I see value in that drink. And as long as I see value in anger, as long as I see value in resentment, as long as I see value in pity, I'll have it. I'll always have it. Well, this sucker, you don't know what he did to me. He did this and that. I got a right to be angry. Well, I once had a right to drink, too. And you act on that right, my friend. But don't come to me and complain about it now that you know. If you didn't know, it would be different. Take the value off it. Take the value off it. I see no anger in my life. I don't have, it has no value in my life. You see, I can come to a meeting on Monday, just say I was kind of new and feeling down, and hear one good thing, and I will hear one good thing because this is a God-given program. And what I do by hearing it means that I don't own it. I don't own anything I hear in these rooms until I practice it out there, until I practice it in my life. If I come in on Monday and hear one good thing and add it to my life, come in on Tuesday, hear something else, add that to my life. Come in on a Wednesday, hear something else, add that to my life. Come on a Thursday, and on and on. Now, let me tell you something. By the weekend, I'm dynamite with the rest of my life to keep growing. That's what we are. We look into, not against. We don't discipline against the drink. We don't discipline against anything negative. We just look into the new and the beautiful, and it starts to become part of us. It starts to become the real us, and that's what's important. And, you know, I think it's getting kind of late, and I'm just getting warmed up. Well, no, I mean it. If you want me to talk, I will. But I don't want Bill to throw me out and say, look, Jimmy, you're running over time. But I'm just going to give you a few clues that I shouldn't say like I'm a teacher. I don't mean that. But one of the things, you know, 25 years, and I'm still going to meetings and passing on what I think is helping me. Some guy in that right there could be saying that guy's a spiritual jerk or a spiritual fool. I mean, it's your business. I understand that. But if somebody can grab on what I got and feel as good as I do every day, I told a guy once, if you don't believe as I do, now you understand why you have the kind of days you do, and I have the kind of days I do. You see? I have dynamite days. I really do. And so when we can understand our mind that anger, resentment, pity, guilt, anything negative. You don't have to write a 400-page book how to vent your anger. You see, anyone that says that, when you say how to vent your anger, first means you believe in it. First means you accept it. It's inside you in order to have to let it out. But if you don't believe in it and if you don't accept it, you don't have to let out that which you never let in. I don't have to let out the thoughts of a drink that I don't let in. And that's what we do with negative emotions. They are destructive. They paralyze you. They hamper you, and they hinder your growth. And anyone that comes back from drinking, going back out and having what they call a slip, we understand what they went through in a sense. I don't. I never went back out, but I don't condemn it. But I do know that I listen for the reasons, for the excuses. And the one is probably failure to be grateful for what sobriety they had, number one. Number two, they wanted to drink more than they wanted to stay sober. But it's usually, well, I got fired, I had an argument with my wife, I this and that. These negatives. A woman came to a meeting once and said, I am so angry, I almost drank today. And they asked for a topic, and a person across the room says, I want to hear more about anger. You see what I'm saying? I don't want anybody in this room to think about the 37 Chevy. Nobody. I don't want nobody to think about the 37 Chevy with the flat tires. I don't want anybody in this room to think about the 37 Chevy with the cracked windshield. I don't want anybody in this room to think about the 37 Chevy with the torn seat covers. What do you think of? You see what I'm saying? You magnify it in your mind. Let's talk about that new cabin cruiser that Fred swiped. That green cabin cruiser with a big yellow stripe around it. Let's think about that new cabin cruiser with the captain's chair. You can sit up in there and act like a big shot, you know. Let's think about that new cabin cruiser that we can fish off the back. Let's think about that new cabin cruiser that we can swim off of. Let's think about that new cabin cruiser. Go down the hold, as they call it, and use the microwave. Who's thinking of the 37 Chevy? See, don't discipline against, discipline into the new and better. God created the world and all was good. Good. Anything negative is man's false belief. Guy says, Jimmy, do you watch the 6 o'clock news? I said, you mean the 6 o'clock crime report? Police report? That's all. I know the surface things in life. I have to know. I'm in this world, but the world is not in me. That's the difference. You see, my friends? And so this is what we do to maintain or to just get a foothold on sobriety. Take the value off that negative stuff. You know, why pay homage to something that's going to destroy you anyway? A guy said to me, Jimmy, if you know, when I first came around here, if Kool-Aid did to you what alcohol did, would you drink Kool-Aid? And I says, no. Unless I got high from it, see? Then I'd be in like Kool-Aid's Anonymous, I guess. I don't know. But I'll tell you the truth, my friends, you know. See, there was value in it. If there's value in it, you go back to it. Take the value off. That's simple to do. Who wants to be a raving idiot, especially in their own home, screaming and howling and trying to be in control? You know, the worst thing a person can do is try to be a controller. When I try to control someone, you know what they do? They immediately, unbeknown to them, start controlling me. Because if they don't act like I want them to, I get whacked out, right? You don't control nobody. You put that burden on yourself. When I first thing that made me feel good about this program, a guy says, easy does it. I said, oh, man, I'm naturally lazy. I'm going to love this. Easy does it. Let's do it that way. But, you know, I'll tell you this. When I was in B Block up in Auburn Prison, you know, I was clerk there for 6 years. I couldn't type when I started, but that's what us guys do. You get into them plush jobs, as they call it. You know, this was 10 cents a day. You kidding me? 4 cent increase. So I'm clerk, and I type up the count and everything. See, 6 years, the longest I ever held a job. Yeah. I said, you know, drink is the curse of the working man. I says, no, work was the curse of the drinking man. This guy says, Jimmy, I lost my job because of the booze. And I says, well, I never had a job because of the booze. Now I'm in Attica working in Auburn now, 6 cents a day, typing up the count. And but I wanted to read books. I wanted to read something, you know, not the westerns and that short heist, as they call it in the joint. It's sex novels and stuff. I was reading educational stuff. I was reading about people who made it in life, not necessarily presidents of company, but them too, you know. But they all talked about this spiritual thing. But I read this book. I'm going to close with this, my friend. I read this book. Bill said, thank you. I read this book, The Agony and the Ecstasy. This is for that movie come out, about Michelangelo. And Michelangelo was known for the Sistine Chapel, the great paintings and everything. The guy was a genius, whatever he did. But he loved to sculpt. That means to carve in marble. That was his real love. He didn't want to paint. He didn't want to. He wanted to sculpt. And marble, he once loved it so much when he'd do them statues and all, run his hands over it. He used to say, "Marble is my mistress." And I says, "Wow, well, I don't know." But he loved it that much. But here's what happened. The Pope in them days commissioned him to do this work, and the statue of David. And I had a friend of mine from the Francesi mob went over in Florence, Italy, and he saw this statue in person, in Poison. And let me tell you something. David, I'm left-handed, but anyway, David, I almost fell off this thing. David's got the slingshot over one shoulder, and Jojo Vitacco. Jojo tells me, "Jimmy," he says, "listen, on the side where he's holding the slingshot, in the marble, you can see the tenseness in muscle. You can see the tenseness. You can feel it in your mind," he says. "And on the other side, you can see relaxation. You can see it and sense it in marble. That's what made these people such great geniuses. In marble, you could see relaxation and tension." The guy's a genius, you know. Well, when they unveiled that thing in the courtyard and all them people were there, you know, and the Roman centurions and the popes and everybody else, and they were all astounded. And they asked Michelangelo, they said, "How did you carve such a beautiful piece of work out of that piece of stone?" And he says, "I didn't." He says, "Yes, you did. We know you did. The Pope commissioned you, and some of us saw you do it. We watched you do it." He says, "No, I didn't carve that." He says, "That statue, as you call it, was always in that piece of marble. All I did was chip away and chip away and chip away until I got to it. And then I polished it and refined it. And there's that beautiful piece of work that was already in there." And let me tell you something, my friends. When you think you got to go outside yourself for anything in life, as far as inner peace and inner joy and understanding, remember this, that all the wonders we seek are already inside us. They're mandated implants. All we have to do with those negatives is chip away and chip away and chip away till we get to that beautiful, powerful person that's inside us. Polish it, refine it, and everyone can have a good day every day. Thank you.